Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the SCANA studio today is Dr. Roger Stroup, formerly director of the South Carolina Department of Archives and History. He's a retired historian, and Roger is working on a history of the South Carolina State Fair, and that organization will celebrate its 150th anniversary in 2019. Roger, welcome to the Journal, and let's talk a little bit, first of all, about you. I've only known you for 40 years.
I was thinking that.
But I don't know about our listeners. Who are you? Where are you from? Where'd you go to school?
Well, I'm a South Carolinian by choice, not by birth. I was born in St. Louis. We moved to Charlotte when I was three. My dad traveled for Brown Shoe Company. And I went to Wofford, graduated, spent 2 years in the Army, and came to graduate school here at Carolina. Got a PhD studying with Ann Hollis and George Rogers, primarily interested in South Carolina, Southern history, cultural history, social history. Went to Historic Columbia for 5 years as their first professional director and curator. Then was at the State Museum for 18 years during its development. And then in 1997 became the director of the Department of Archives and History and also, of course, served as State Historic Preservation Officer.
So you have spent almost all of your adult life in South Carolina and working on South Carolina history.
That's correct.
So, and actually, your dissertation was fairly interesting. You want to just briefly talk about that? Because you wrote about a senator that nobody remembers very much.
Senator John McLaren from Bennettsville. He was a Tillmanite, became member of the House of Representatives, Attorney General, and then he went to the Senate from 1897 to 1902. 1897 to 1902. And he and Ben Tillman had a fight on the floor of the United States Senate. That was their claim to fame.
Frankly, Senator, I think Senator McLaren is forgotten, but given his political views, particularly on the economy and business, he would be right in line with contemporary South Carolina.
Oh, he would, exactly. And that's what cost him his seat in the Senate in 1902 when he had to run again because Tillman was totally opposed to all of his Republican ideas. And so McLaren lost his seat in the Senate and then came back to South Carolina and became the state warehouse commissioner for the cotton warehouse system in the teens.
Well, we're talking politics. To a certain degree, was the state fair burst in politics?
Not really. The state fair that we have today, yes, was, but they actually were state fairs prior to the Civil War.
All right. Well, let's talk about those.
All right. Well, the earliest fairs that I've been able to track down, thanks to George Rogers, Charleston and the Age of the Pinckneys, he had citations as early as 1723. We find references to fairs at places like Childsbury, which is just outside of Charleston. And they were local fairs. They didn't have carnival rides and things like that, but they were where the farmers and the planters got together. They had competitions, you know, horse racing, shooting.
Cockfights.
They had prizes for the best crops, for the best livestock, things like that. So that started in the 1720s, and I don't think it ever really stopped. It continued on until the late 18th century, when there was an agricultural society started that began to have some meetings, and they started a little more formal. They would actually periodically have papers read where someone would present a paper about farming practices or things like that in the late 18th century. And then in the early 19th century, we began to get things like the Pendleton Farmers Society. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of those around the state, which mm-hmm. were the farmers met mm-hmm. locally.
Yeah, Beech Island. Others. And what you're describing to me sounds very much like the old English county fair or a country fair.
A country market sort of thing where they did that. This sort of thing, they would last for 3 or 4 days because even traveling 15, 20, 25 miles in those days was quite a chore. It took some time. So they would travel and spend 3 or 4 days and have all these activities and, you know, pass out information, learn from each other. And I'm sure there were politics and economic issues discussed at these as well.
And South Carolina, actually, you just couldn't have a fair. You had to get, it had to be licensed by the Commons House of Assembly. They had to authorize permission to hold a fair. You couldn't just say, I'm going to have a fair.
Well, in the earliest one, I found something like that as well. There was one in Kershaw County, which the king actually also gave them a permit to have a fair in Kershaw County in the late 18th century as well, which is one of the earliest ones I found straight documentation for like that.
Interesting history. So by 1860, are we getting any statewide fairs, or is it still basically county fairs?
County fairs are stronger. There were actually two pre-Civil War fair groups. There was the State Agricultural Society, started in the mid-1830s, and by 1839 they had organized enough and created to have a fair in Columbia, and they ran a fair every year from 1840 through 1845. It was on the State House grounds, and the activities were primarily agriculture-related. With speeches in the chamber of the House of Representatives.
Now we're still talking about the old State House, right?
The old State House. This would have been the old State House, the wooden State House. To my knowledge, as best I can find, there really was nothing that we would consider like the midway, the games, or the rides. This was pretty much a strictly agricultural fair. And it died simply because people had trouble getting to Columbia. It became a local fair. They tried some fairs in Greenville and Newberry. And those worked out pretty well. But again, they were only local people. So by 1845, they had one then. 1846, no fair. And from 1846 till 1855, the society kind of died. Then it was rebirthed again in 1855 with the same name, many of the same people involved. And in 1856, they held a fair on the new fairgrounds, which at that point was on Elmwood Avenue, where Logan and Wardlaw schools are today. And there's, I think, a historical marker there. And the fairgrounds there, the city provided them the property, and they raised the money and built a building on the site. And there was a fair from 1856 to 1861. They even had a fair after the war started in 1861.
All right. Now, can we kind of put this in context? Because I know you've been working on this, and you learned this from George Rogers in particular, and that is to put local history in context. What is going on nationally in terms of state fairs? Where does this effort in the 1840s in South Carolina, what are they doing in Ohio or Indiana or Vermont or wherever?
This is one of the older state fairs. Most of those state fairs, again, they, like South Carolina, had local fairs. But most of the state fairs as we think of them today evolved after the war. And most of those evolved in the Midwest and then moved elsewhere in the country. For example, North Carolina State Fair evolved around the same time ours did after the war. But before the war, there were also attempts. And the reason the fair succeeded from 1855 to 1861 was we had railroads. If you think about it, in 1845, the only place you could go on the railroad was from Charleston to Columbia and to North Augusta. By 1855, Columbia had connections to Charleston, Greenville, Spartanburg, Charlotte, and Camden. So you were able to bring things to the state and have a state fair rather than just the local fair. So that really is what, and the railroads really encouraged that. The railroads really got on board and encouraged people. Special fairs.
I was going to say special rates to get to the fair.
Exactly.
And was it, even though it's based here in Columbia, was it truly a statewide organization in terms of board and organization and that kind of thing?
It was, yeah. The leading members were from around the state. It was weighted toward Columbia. But some of the stronger fairs were really in other parts of the state, like Pendleton, Anderson, Newberry. They had some fairs before the war, which were local, and you didn't have to win that fair to go to the state fair. It was totally separate. It wasn't like a competition to get into it.
So the state fair was just another one of many fairs still going. It called itself the state fair, right?
Right.
But you still, as you mentioned, you've got strong local fairs going on in Newberry, Anderson. I noticed you mentioned upcountry towns where these state fairs are going on. Now, you're not talking about anything back down in Childsbury again?
Well, actually, the South Carolina Institute created a fair, and they were organized in the late 1840s, and they ran a fair in Charleston that was mostly more an industrial fair and agriculture for products and plows and things like that, though they did have prizes for livestock and whatnot. And they operated a fair until 1870, actually, in Charleston. It was called the South Carolina Institute Fair, and it ran And there was always, in the 1850s, those fairs in the late 50s, there's always interesting information in the paper about the two. But then many times somebody who entered one fair would then go enter the other because they weren't at the same time. They were usually a couple weeks apart.
Today we think of food competitions at the state fair. Those biscuits wouldn't last from one fair to the other. You can make them again, but you're talking primarily about farm animals and...
Primarily livestock, things like that, though they did also have at the early state fairs art exhibits. There's a great painting at the State Museum that I actually acquired when I was there from a donor here in Columbia, which shows a mill on the river. And we didn't know where that mill was till I started on the work on the book and ran across a citation in the late 1850s talking about a painting by Eugene de Valliers of Young's Mill. We now know what that painting is, and it was exhibited at the State Fair in one of the late 1850s. And so I've got a list of things that were exhibited, and those are some of the things that will be used as illustrations in the book.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the Institute of Fairs in Charleston. That sounds very much like the great exhibitions that were beginning to be had in England and France and everywhere that were primarily industrial products.
That was what they primarily were, with the industrial fairs and the agricultural fairs, to promote both the industry as well as agriculture for the state.
I seem to remember looking at the things exhibited at one of those Charleston fairs, and it was to promote local industry. Buy local, don't buy from New York, don't buy, you know, there were buggies, it was brooms, stained glass windows. I mean, you mentioned it, just page after page of what was being produced here, and that was, quite frankly, a lot of people don't remember or realize that. We didn't have huge industry in South Carolina for a very good reason, but we had a lot of small craft-like industries going on.
Exactly, and you find the actual premium books for those actually have premium listing of what they're going to give for these prizes, and they turn around, and on the other page there are advertisements for the businesses. You'll get advertisements for the local wagon makers, for gunsmiths, for silversmiths, things like that are advertised in the premium books for the fairs.
Premium books, premiums, advertising, you know, sounds like you're talking about the fair in 2010 or 1976.
Well, it was, because they were promoting the state, the same sort of thing, and providing people an opportunity to show their wares. You know, the earliest premium I've actually found is an 1841 silver trophy won by Wade Hampton at the second state fair, held at that point in that group. And it was one of three trophies which descended in a family here in Columbia. Found an article in the 1950s about the trophies, and we've managed to track down one of them. Still looking for the other two.
And the trophy you found, Roger, what is it for? With Hampton, I say it's got to be the horse.
One of them was for horse, but one of them was for a swine. I can't remember what the other one was. They were all three from that 1841 fair.
But the one you actually found
is for the swine.
For swine. Okay, best one. Best pigs.
Best pigs. But we're still looking for the other two.
All right. We've obviously got, to, you know, 1861, you said, was the last fair, and it was held after the war was going on, which is interesting. Civil War was going on. When does the story of the modern state fair, the one that we're dealing with now, pick up?
Picks up in 1869. The fairgrounds were actually burned by Sherman because the university, or the South Carolina College at that point, had created a laboratory there for Dr. LeConte, and he was doing research for the Confederacy, and so that was a legitimate target. So it was actually burned a couple days after Sherman came into town.
Wasn't he dealing with niter and gunpowder?
He was.
Okay.
He was.
You're grinning because you're talking about what he was collecting to make his niter with.
Right.
He went around Columbia collecting urine, which was then distilled to make ingredients for gunpowder.
Exactly. So that was a legitimate target for the. So in 1869, they had to rebuild the fairgrounds facilities. The fair evolved in 1869.
This is still private now. This is not, when we say state fair, it is not a state agency.
It was not a state agency. It has never been a state agency. The state fair organization is now a 501c3 private organization. Has been since the beginning. It was a private group that started the state fair, And they started in 1869. They really started it to get together primarily the planter, pre-war planters and the yeoman farmers in the state as a really attempt to get rid of Reconstruction.
So it did have a political...
It did. It was the same time, just shortly after the KKK started, Ku Klux Klan started. There was a Women's Monument Association, which was started.
The Taxpayers' Conventions.
Taxpayers' Conventions. So it really was an opportunity or a chance to really get the folks back together and do that. And when they started it, the pre-war one had been the agricultural fair. This one really created itself as an agricultural and mechanical fair. So it specifically started in 1869 to talk about, and they put this in their Constitution and Minutes, specifically to talk about the agricultural as well as the industrial aspects of the state. So it had grown from just the agriculture.
Roger, you mentioned that getting this, you know, the founding of the State Fair in 1869 was the beginning of efforts to get rid of Reconstruction. Do you want to be a little bit more detail on that?
Well, of course, as you know, radical Republicans were in charge of the legislature, but carpetbaggers, scallywags, the freedmen had a majority in the legislature. And so the pre-war planters were not in control of the state. So they really wanted to get people back together, primarily white people, of course, back together to regain control of the state. And this was an opportunity for them to get together and discuss politics and plan things as well as really begin to promote the industrial and the agricultural resources of the state.
But they had a political party, right? I mean, was this to do something kind of undercover or?
Well, it wasn't the Democratic Party. I mean, all of these people were members of the Democratic Party, of course. Out of the 1869 State Fair, the Ladies Monument Association I mentioned actually met during that fair. Another organization called the South Carolina Club met and it organized itself during that fair. And the South Carolina Club planned to have a ball every year at the State Fair, which they did until the 19-teens. And it was held in the State House most of the time. And it was a huge event on Thursday during Fair Week. But it was organized specifically, and in the newspaper articles about it, it talks about to be able to get the folks, pre-war planter class, back together once again to really push Reconstruction and get the Union troops out of South Carolina and get us back to normal.
Okay. So, like most things in South Carolina, they get birthed in politics, but that's okay. It's part of our history. Let's talk about that first new state, and when I say new state fair, the new organization, 1869, what was that first fair like? Obviously here in Columbia, did they rebuild things at the old fairgrounds again up on the edge of town, Elmwood area today?
Exactly, yeah. They built a new building there. They had a contract from the city. The city allowed them to use the property again with the stipulation that they have to hold a fair every year to keep the property. So they built a facility. The city helped with that.
And this is an exhibition facility.
This is an exhibition. A two-story exhibition facility is built there. And the best place to really see what it looks like is go to the 1872 bird's eye view map of Columbia. And it shows you that building, and it shows you the racetrack. There was a half-mile racetrack built there as well because the horse racing was such an important part of the fair activities. So that is there as well. And so they hold the fair over about 4 days.
Oh, what time of year are they doing this?
In November. Okay. It starts out really in November, and then over the years it kind of moves itself back into October. The first couple of years, in fact, the first year description of the fair talks about it being muddy and whatnot, walking up Main Street to get up to the fairgrounds, and talks about even though it was a terrible day and cold and rainy, didn't hold people back. They still really crowded to the fairgrounds to see the activities.
Well, I'm thinking about Columbia in 1869, which you still got vacant lots and no paved streets to speak of. That's not an easy walk from, say, Gervais and Richardson, which was the old name, from Main Street. You walk from the state capitol up to Elmwood, that's a pretty fur piece even today on sidewalks.
It's a mile. It's basically a mile, just about, yeah. So people came up to the fairgrounds to visit. And, of course, at that point, there were no trolleys or buses, or, you know, so it was walk or coming wagons.
Well, are the trains running again?
The trains are running again. Yeah, the trains, you know, even after the destruction of Sherman's army in 1865, the trains are pretty much back in operation by about 1867, 1868. So you've got the trains running to Columbia. Of course, that track is back in place going to Spartanburg and Greenville. And then, of course, the train coming in from Charleston.
And the station was, in today, it's Columbia's Vista. This is before the Union Station was built.
Right. This is before the station was, well, the station for the Charlotte and Columbia Railroad was across the street from what's now Benedict University on Laurel Street. And the station for the South Carolina Railroad that came out of Charleston was in the Vista, which is now Wet Willie's.
Oh, okay. All right. So you're still talking a distance to get there.
Absolutely.
What were some of the exhibits at this 1869? We knew about the politics, and I'll get back into that in a second, whether they were having oratorial contests, but what were people exhibiting? The usual that you would expect at the fair?
Yeah, I mean, the exhibits, even they picked up with the post-war fairs with the same thing the pre-war fairs had. They had domestic departments where they did things that were cooked, knit, quilts, canned goods. All the industrial equipment, you begin to find people advertising plows, cotton gins, all those kinds of things are advertised as well. And so there's lots of broad categories. The premium lists are fascinating to read because they would give prizes for all kinds of things. And they were giving, at that point, diplomas and cash prizes primarily.
Even if it was a small amount in 1869, it would have been a nice prize to have.
I mean, you look at the list and it's, you know, $1, $2, $5.
But
that's a lot more money than it is today.
Considerably more. I don't have my conversion table here, but I would say at least 10 times that. I
mean, yeah, I'm sure.
But $1 in 1869 could buy you a great deal.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a loaf of bread was a penny or two pennies. So you were able to buy much more than you obviously can buy a dollar with today.
Was there an admission charge to the fair?
There was a small admission charge to the fair. I think it was 20. I think it initially was 25 cents.
All right. Again, in the day, that's not cheap.
No, that's not cheap. I have a great letter from the 1890s, just to give you an idea, that's at the Carolinianna Library, where a lady, young lady's riding her dad from Winthrop. She's coming to the fair, and it's going to cost her $1 to ride the train round trip, 10 cents at that point to ride the trolley round trip from Union Station out to the fairgrounds, which is Elmwood. I think it was 25 cents admission, and then she put in 10 or 15 cents for meal, food, lunch. So for less than $2, she can come to the fair from Rock Hill and come and go back home.
Well, and by the 1890s, Columbia was a railroad hub.
Yeah.
What, six railroads coming into the town?
At least.
And so you could be anywhere in the state within the day. People came to Columbia to shop in the 1890s.
Right. You could come to Columbia in for the day, spend the day, and then get back home at night without having to spend the night in Columbia.
Okay. So after 1869, you know, we talked about the politics. Did they have debates or anything like that? Are they politicking, or is still we're just concerned about exhibits and products and that kind of thing?
There is generally at the fair orations where they would give speeches. And they weren't actually like campaign speeches. They were more positions, economic positions for the betterment of the farmers and the planters, those kinds of things. Speeches always talking about new ways to farm, better farming methods, opportunities. Demonstrations of new plows and new planting techniques, things like that, were constantly going on. I didn't run across any really speeches that were advocating particular candidates. I'm sure that went on behind the scenes. But by focusing on positions, of course, a political position or an economic position, they were certainly pushing a political agenda one way or the other. Interesting fact is that every year they mentioned they had to have a fair every year or they lost the property that the city gave them. In 1876, everybody was so involved with the election. That's the election when Wade Hampton was running as governor and there were two people elected and that whole mess. And suddenly the state fair dates came upon them and they realized they didn't have one. So one farmer from upstate brought down a couple dozen of his livestock and they paraded it around the fairgrounds, and the red shirts, basically, and this is from the newspaper, the red shirts were there clapping and cheering, and so they considered that the state fair for the year, so they didn't lose the property from the city.
Explain who the red shirts are.
Well, the red shirts were the Democratic Party, the pre-war planter class, and their followers who really were pushing to get Reconstruction out of South Carolina and get the troops gone.
But they're a paramilitary group.
They are. They are, yeah.
They were not hooded. They were not the Klan, but they were a show of force by the Democratic Party.
Right. And so that's they were at the fairgrounds that night, so that day. So that was the state fair for that year.
Must have had a really good lawyer to...
Yeah, there's not great descriptions, unfortunately.
Okay. We've got to pause for a moment to let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dr. Roger Stroop about the history of the South Carolina State Fair. All right, Roger, back to the 19th century, because in the decades after the Civil War, state fairs begin to spring up everywhere, and they become, they bring in entertainment and that kind of thing. What about our state fair?
Our fair evolves very much the way the other fairs do. One of the unique things of our fair, which I found out, and I have not found this in any secondary sources yet, that beginning in the 1870s, the fairground was about 30 acres on Elmwood Avenue. And what happened was that basically was filled up with all the industrial and the agricultural and the racetrack for the horses and all those sort of things. So in the 1870s, the fair begins to spread over into Main Street. This happens in other states as well, but they primarily are just outside the fairgrounds area. By the 1870s and the late 1870s into the mid-1880s, there's actually an organization created called the Columbia Fair Association in the late 1880s. And their job is to handle all of the activities up and down Main Street, which includes everything except the agricultural and the domestic sections and the industrial sections of the fair. So the midway, okay, the entertainment, the shows, the freak shows, the girly shows, all of that.
Girly shows in the 19th century?
Well, very late 19th century elsewhere. The first ones here are early 20th century. But that all begins to happen on Main Street because there's not room on the fairground. So the fair would close at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. Everything moves to Main Street. There's a description of a merry-go-round in the intersection of, I think it's Washington Street and what's now Main Street, Richardson Street then, in there. So up and down Main Street, all these activities take, they have great descriptions of Main Street with, you know, hundreds of colored lights and banners. Found no photographs yet. There got to be some photographs of that from the late 19th century.
Well, but again, if it's done at night, I think the street lights were still gas.
They were until the early 20th century. They changed over. And actually, the activities stayed on Main Street until 1914. Most of those kind of activities stayed on Main Street. We can talk about that in a moment, why that changed. Until 1914. So all this is up and down Main Street, which nobody really realized. And they're great descriptions.
Well, you know, with what you're talking about, the things that are ancillary to the fair. Now you've got the Midway. You still got the South Carolina Ball.
Yeah, the South Carolina Ball is going on. It becomes a big, big event.
And so, but see, it's being held right at the foot of Main Street. It's being held in the State House still, right?
Being held in the State House through about 1900. And then when they redid the State House, as you recall, in the early 20th century, 1903, I think they redid the State House, put on the dome, and they bought new furniture in the House of Representatives. And the House members said, wait a minute, we're tired of people moving our furniture in and out and getting it scratched. So they stopped letting it be used for anything except the Democratic Party's convention when they held it. So they stopped holding it in the State House for a while and moved to other venues in town. But the South Carolina Ball was a huge social event. By the 1890s, it becomes a debutante ball. Mm-hmm. You go to the state newspaper in the late 1890s, there'll be two or three pages of descriptions of what all the ladies were wearing and whatnot. I mean, it's amazing that this was going on. And it's something that really nobody's researched much or talked much about. It becomes a major event until 1917.
So it dies out with the war.
Dies out. And the one thing we need to let folks know is that every year since 1869, there has been a state fair except 1918. And the 1918 fair did not happen, not because of the war, but because of the influenza. That's when the big flu epidemic was going on around the country. So about a month before the fair, they decided, and the Board of Health said, you really should not hold a fair. So they didn't. So there was no South Carolina ball that year. They tried to get it going again in 1919 and 1920, weren't successful. They tried one more time in 1921, and there's a great quote in the paper when somebody says, listen, there's no sense having a big ball if we can't drink, because Prohibition had already started by that point. So it dies out completely. And then there are a couple of the local clubs that begin in the 1920s that are the debutante clubs now that really pick up where that left off.
Okay, actually, some of them are a little bit earlier than that. The Assembly was started in the 19th century.
Yeah.
All right, so really, if you look from the 1880s up until World War One, during Fair Week, and it is a week, right?
It runs basically from Tuesday through Saturday.
Columbia is just one big fairgrounds.
It is a huge plus for Columbia. I mean, it is an amazing opportunity for Columbia to promote itself, and they actually spend a lot of time promoting other things in the city, like the Confederate Relic Room, tell people visit the State House, visit the Columbia Canal, which was fairly new.
And the farmers market's right down there on Assembly Street.
Right. So they promoted all of those things as Columbia. It was a huge plus. I mean, one of the big issues they had, really, the pre-war fairs as well as up into the early 20th century, they had a problem housing everybody. They actually set up a housing bureau where people would rent out rooms in their house because the hotels couldn't hold everybody coming to town for 3 or 4 days. So they actually set up a housing bureau to set that up as well. And it was a huge boon to the city. Each year, they made lots of money. The merchants, we mentioned the fair activities were on Main Street until 1914. The fair moved from Elmwood to its current location in 1904. And that's because they outgrew the fairground facilities up here, needed more space, wanted to put it all within one entity. So they moved there, but they continued to have things on Main Street, even though there was some friction between the fair and the local merchants. Because the local merchants liked the fact that people were downtown, they ate in their restaurants, mm-hmm. They shopped in their stores. The stores stayed open late at night so people could shop when they were up and down what was the midway on Main Street till 1914. And then the fair finally says, wait a minute, you know, we just need to get all this consolidated. And one of the things I just found out last week doing some research at the public library, Richland County Public Library, was in 1915 and 16, the 2 years after they stopped that, a part of the fair program was something called a trades parade, and there's a great postcard of it from 1915 in the county library collection that talks about the trades parade and the advertisements in the paper. Only Columbia merchants, they had a parade that started at 4:30. It went up Main Street. It was part of the fair schedule. It's on the fair schedule. And this was sort of the token to the local merchants to do that. And they had the fair at 4:30, so when the fair was over with, guess what? People were downtown. They could go to the restaurants and eat. So,
but that was for
two years only. I can't find it happening after that, okay. Just those first 2 years.
And we haven't even mentioned Big Thursday.
Big Thursday, everybody thinks Big Thursday happened because of the football game. It actually happened because that was the day that most things happened at the fair, including the South Carolina ball. And the legislature actually enacted legislation creating Big Thursday, I think it was 1906. I'd have to check my notes. Before the Carolina-Clemson game became the function for Big Thursday. So it really started out not as a football game. Of course, the first Carolina-Clemson game was in the early 1890s, and there were several games, and then there was a riot, which you probably know more about than I do, but there was a not a riot, but an encounter between Clemson and Carolina students in 1903, I think it was.
They canceled the series.
They canceled the series for a number of years.
Yeah, they had to ring out the militia.
Yeah, they did.
But when did it become an integral part of the state fair?
Early 1900s. The first games were actually played on a football field in the old fairgrounds on Elmwood Avenue in the 1890s. And then they had the rift, and they didn't run it for a number of years. It started again around 1908, 1909 with an every year competition. And by the 1920s, it is the thing that you really hear about on Big Thursday because the South Carolina ball is gone. and some of the other activities, the bigger activities, were on Thursday. So they would aim for people to come in on a train on Tuesday or Wednesday, stay through Thursday and Friday night. Thursday night was the ball, Friday, and into Saturday.
By the time the fair has moved to its current location, are there stands there?
Yeah, they built a stadium in the corner on Rosewood Avenue, if you know where Jayco's is. Yeah. On Rosewood Avenue, right across from there. There was a stadium right in that corner of the fairgrounds. And that's where the game was actually played until what's now Williams-Brice, was built in 1934, 1935. So that was where the game was held every year on fairgrounds. And in order to go to the game, you had to buy an admission ticket to the fair. And that lasts into the middle of the 20th century.
I want to go back to the Main Street Midway, because I just think that was fascinating, because I have read some of the descriptions about almost at every intersection. You mentioned the merry-go-round, but there was a special event. Some of them were like a circus. They'd have acrobats and tightrope walkers and this kind of thing. And all of this lit by gaslight. I mean, it just would have been a great Hollywood scene. I mean, but this is, everybody's out there in the street. It's October, the weather's good, and there's something for everybody.
Yeah, going on all up and down the street, the side streets, as well as the Opera House had special performances that were brought in. Other theaters in town had special performances that were brought in, specifically with Fair Week. So, I mean, it was a huge time for Columbia.
The Opera House, of course, was on the site of what used to be the Wade Hampton Hotel. It was the corner of Main and Gervais.
Right.
And according to folks who know, I learned this from an audio engineer, an old elderly gentleman, the old Opera House had among the best acoustics in the Southeast, which is why they were able to get such big acts, because, and this is pre-microphone and amplifier days, you had to have a good voice and what have you. The entire interior was wooden. So, yes, you've got big acts going on there at the Opera House. And, of course, all of this disappears. You said 1915, 1916, and everything is then on the current location of the fairgrounds, which was really on the edge of Columbia.
It was. And, folks, by the 1910, they had run double-track trolley out there from downtown.
Okay.
So you could get out there without too much of a problem. As I said, I think it was a dime round trip for the hot trolley in the late 19th century. So that provided people a way to get there. They still went downtown. If you look at the ads in the newspapers, all the merchants downtown in the teens, 20s, 30s, as I looked at ads, would talk about specials.
Again, the railroad stations are downtown.
Exactly.
So it's great commercial enterprise for the city of Columbia. But again, the State Fair organization, it's not owned by the city. It's not owned by the state. It is completely a private, as you said, 501c3 operation.
An organization it is. And it has done a great job of keeping the fair going. North Carolina, for example, started out with a private organization, but in the 1930s during the Depression, it could not handle it, so the state took it over. So North Carolina, and there are probably, we're still trying to find out, there are about a half a dozen maybe fairs around the country, state fairs, that are run by something besides a state entity like the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Natural Resources run the fair, something like that. One of the things we need to back up on, getting into the politics of things, is in the 1890s, and that's the creation of the Colored State Fair.
That was one thing I was going to ask. When all of these people are thronging downtown on Main Street, is the Midway segregated?
It is integrated, as best I can tell, up until about the late 1880s, when you begin to get the passage of the Jim Crow laws, the segregation laws coming in.
No, that's 1890s in South Carolina.
So at that point in time, and I'm going to use the term they use, was the colored population was unhappy because they were having trouble getting into the fair and they were not treated properly. So in 1889, they created their own organization, the Colored State Fair Association, and that's what they called it. And they created a fair, and they held their first fair in January of 1890 on the state fair grounds. So the white, and I'm going to use the term white state fair, which is what they called it, the White State Fair Association rented the grounds to them. So they held it usually the week following the state fair. So in 1890, they had one in January and then one in the fall. And then in 1891, they had another one. And then in 1892, there were two different factions of the colored state fair fighting each other. And from then until about 1907, there were on and off kind of colored state fairs of various types.
Well, you've also got, in the meantime, what becomes South Carolina State University is created, which has an agricultural and a mechanical component to it.
It does, and it begins to help with the state fair playing the same. And you also have in the early 1890s Clemson created, which begins to work with the white state fair to help provide the agricultural expertise and whatnot necessary. So you got those two things going along parallel. In 1908, a gentleman named Richard Carroll becomes involved, who's an African-American individual here in town, and he really takes on the role of leadership, and they create the Colored State Fair again, and they have a fair in 1908, and it is fairly successful, and they really ran fairs every year again except 1918. Until 1969.
By that time, they were calling it the Palmetto State Fair.
The name changed after the war.
Which war? We've been through a lot of wars.
World War II. They started using the term Palmetto State Fair in the 1950s, but they formally changed the name in 1965.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's, for some folks, the South Carolina State Fair was always the white state fair.
It was, and it actually, you know, the first thing that I found really that specifically was integrated was 1965. The 4-H clubs were integrated, which really operated under the auspices of Clemson. Hmm. And they were actually integrated in 1965, the year after the Civil Rights Act in 1964. But they continued to have the Palmetto State Fair, as they called it, through 1969.
And it was actually same
on the same fairgrounds.
The week after.
The week after. Sometimes some of the rides stayed over. Sometimes they didn't. It depended exactly on working with the carnival operator is exactly what happened in there. But they continued to have, as best I can tell from the records we've been able to find, they continued to have competition in the 4-H clubs. Separately at that point until the 1969 Color State Fair was the last one. In 1970, the gentleman who ran the state fair passed away, and by that time, the fair was becoming more integrated.
Now, you say the gentleman who ran the state fair or the Palmetto State
Fair? Palmetto State Fair, the Color State Fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that organization just went away?
Just went away in 1970.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Who are the folks who run the state fair?
It is now a private, nonprofit board of trustees. They are self-perpetuating. They meet once a year, a major meeting once a year, and then there are executive committee meetings throughout the year as necessary and sometimes on a regular basis. And they elect their own members through the membership meeting organization. They have actual meetings and elect the members. So it's a self-perpetuating group of folks. They're from all over the state. They are the ones who are responsible for operating the fair. They hire a secretary manager, and he basically, he or she, it's a he right now, he basically runs the day-to-day operations under their guidance and their guidelines.
Okay. And isn't the board by congressional district or judicial districts?
It is. Yeah, it's by congressional districts and a couple of open seats or general seats across the board.
The fair has changed. I've been in Columbia since 1965. It's changed considerably since then. I can remember my first year in graduate school here at Carolina. We went out to the fair. Somebody had to hit a car. They weren't running trolleys there. But it was a young college boy's wonder world. I mean, you walked right in the gate, and there were the beer gardens, and then tucked away on the corner over towards Bluff Road were the girly shows.
They were, yeah. Okay, the girly shows were here until 1975.
When did they? You mentioned they started in the 1890s. Huh?
They started elsewhere in the 18. Earliest one I've been able to find in Columbia at the State Fair here is the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. There's a quote from Richard Carroll, who ran the Colored State Fair in 1905, 6, 7, that time frame, in which he's quoted as saying that he thinks it's not a good idea that they continue to have the girly shows viewed by men of both races. So that tells me that at that point, there was some integration of the fairs, even though there was a separate colored fair in 1908. When he made that quote, I don't think there was a separate, there was not a separate colored fair. So I know they were there that early. And then they continued on, and you run into advertisements in the paper. And by the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, you're finding articles in the newspapers where they're talking with the performers, the people who are running the fair and the girly shows.
Well, nationally, this kind of started with the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, didn't it?
1893 in Little Egypt.
Yeah.
Yeah, a dancer called Little Egypt who had more clothes on than most women wear on the street these days in the summertime. But it sort of started there and went on to that point.
And you also had, you mentioned the freak shows, sort of the Ripley's Believe It or Not kind of.
You had the bearded lady, you had the fat lady, you had the cow with two heads and those kinds of things. And those were gone from our fair, at least the individual, the people, the fat lady and the bearded lady. Those were all gone from the show by the late 1980s. I think the last one I document is about 85 or 86.
And that's, again, that's not just true here. That's kind of nationwide.
It's across the country.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those were run by the carnivals. You know, in the early 20th century, the fairs began to contract with somebody to bring in the food vendors, the sideshows, the games of chance, and the rides. Mm-hmm. So that was all handled by an outside contract.
Yeah, I forgot to mention the games of chance, which supposedly are illegal in South Carolina.
Supposedly illegal. But, you know, again, it's like the rides. You know, there's state oversight of those kinds of things. You mentioned the beer mm-hmm. when you went to the state fair. That had become such a problem by, the mid-1980s. In the mid-1980s, they decided to cancel the beer concessions and get beer off the state fairgrounds. And since then, they've had a lot less trouble.
Not only were there complaints from the college boys, because, of course, the drinking age had not changed that. It was still 18 at that point. Mm-hmm. But there were a number of local, not just local charities that made their budgets by running beer tents.
Well, they ran the food service vendors. A lot of those were the food service vendors. I mean, Dreher High School had a booth, and that was where the band made their money for their year, and there were many of those. Those disappeared again in the late 1980s.
So everything now, when you have food vendors at the state fair, basically the state fair has contracted with somebody to bring in
all of those. Yeah, there are a few local ones that the fair may bring in, but most of that comes in with the show that comes.
Roger, I want to back up just a little bit historically. When they abandoned Main Street in the Opera House, when did they begin to have the big shows in the grandstand?
They started having those in the 20s.
1920s, okay.
Of various types. I mean, the grandstand was there, and of course, the one thing we didn't talk about was the horse racing and the stables that were at the fairgrounds. From the 1890s to the 1960s, Columbia was a wintering place for horses from the Northeast, from the major stables.
And hey, did we have several Kentucky Derby winners?
We had five Kentucky Derby winners, one Triple Crown winner that were wintered here in Columbia as well. And they had the Palmetto Trials from 1952 to 1969, which were races in March, horse races at the racetrack. And that was a huge social event as well as an economic boon for Columbia. Because think of the number of, with several hundred horses here, think of the number of trainers and whatever else that came in, spent the winter here in Columbia as well.
Well, the state fair has really gotten modern. It's no longer sawdust. The sideshows are all gone. But you can still meet somebody at the Rocket.
You can still meet somebody at the Rocket. That's right. Rocket came in 1969. It was the last thing that Frank Hampton did as president of the fair. It had been sitting here for 6 years and nobody put it up. And he finally got together some business people and all that, you know, funded it and put the work in, put it up in 1969. So the Rocket's been there since 1969. So anybody growing up in Columbia in that time period since then, that's Meet Your Mother at the Rocket is sort of a side light of the fair.
Well, Roger Alford's given me the wind-up sign. Any general comments about, as a historian, your work on this book and where you might think it's going to end up?
Well, it's been fascinating to really work on it because I knew the general thought of the fair by having attended many fairs over the years, but did not realize how much it really tied in and reflected the history of the state and what was going on in South Carolina with things like civil rights, integration, the Jim Crow laws, the ability of people to gather and use that as an opportunity before we had telephones and things like that, and really the importance of that and the importance of it to people who participated in the like the 4-H clubs. Those were a huge activity, a chance for the children to really come in and win prizes and gain recognition for the work they were doing.
And hey, us amateur gardeners too. I have a drawer full of ribbons for my cut flowers. Don't enter them anymore, but I did once upon a time.
And there must be lots of people with drawers full of medals and silver trophies because we've only found a few of them out there, actually. And they gave hundreds of medals and hundreds of silver trophies over the years for very special kinds of things. And I've only so far located a couple of them.
Well, I must say, though, that the prize money is not what it used to be because you talked about in 1869 they were given a dollar or $5. That's what they were still given in the 1970s. Okay. Dr. Roger Stroop, I want to thank you for being with us today on The Journal.
My pleasure.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know I did, reminiscing with Dr. Stroop about the State Fair more recently in my time, since 1965, but going all the way back in South Carolina history, to the 1720s and the origin of fairs. It's a fascinating social and cultural history. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.